You know, I think of Mother's Day, I'm reminded that kids really deserve a mom and a dad. And by the way, Andy Stanley said some controversial things this week, but I agree, in part.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, a shout out to all the moms out there. Happy Mother's Day. One day late here on the Line of Fire. Got a whole bunch of things to talk to you about as it is Monday and so much happens over the weekend and so much builds up in my own heart to talk to you about. To get in the conversation, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. I saw a headline on Drudge Report today that ISIS was threatening, quote, a message to America attack at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I believe they do have enough deluded people in the country that would die in the cause of their murderous campaign and might do something. I don't believe they have the level of coordination needed to pull off some major attack, but it's been threatened. Matt, we'll just keep an eye out on the news, but all the more reason to just be vigilant. I don't mean looking over your shoulder, but vigilant in prayer and keeping your life in right relationship with God. All right, an anecdote about my mother. She's now 92 years old. Went over to visit her yesterday in her apartment in an elderly care facility. She has her own apartment and takes care of herself. Folks just come in to help with a few things during the day. 92 years old, physically weak, but mentally sharp. So we hung out some. I'd run a few errands for her. And then, as our custom is, we played a best of five match of gin. It doesn't matter if someone wins three games, we still play five. And even though it was Mother's Day, I was able to triumph, but she's beaten me more than I've beaten her. But I thanked her for being such a wonderful mother. And she said, well, you've always been a good boy. And that leads to the anecdote, because some of you think back to the role of moms in your life, and some of you had a rocky upbringing, and maybe your mom struggled a lot, had her own issues, and couldn't be there for you. But most of us have appreciative thoughts about our mothers, things that they did on our behalf that only a mother could do, just like there's things only a father could do. The world's best mother is not a father, and the world's best father is not a mother. Well, years back, when we were involved in the Brownsville Revival in Pensacola, Florida, the local newspaper, the Pensacola News Journal, wrote a series of articles, probably 30 or 40 articles over a period of years, about the revival that were very positive articles, celebrating what had happened there and all the good it had done for Pensacola, and just various positive stories. And at a certain point, I don't know why, but they turned hostile, and they began to write things very negative and critical and all these outlandish false accounts. I knew they were false. I was an insider in what God was doing there. And there was one journalist in particular that was seemed to us diabolical. I mean, he would actually call your parents and say, okay, I read this story about your son, your daughter. Oh, fascinating. And try to probe them with questions so as to get the parent unknowingly to contradict the child. And, you know, you may tell the same story two different ways, and you may think, oh, I got a contradiction, where there's nothing of the kind. Well, by the time I got around to calling my mom, and it was on a Mother's Day that I finally called her to say, hey, you may be getting a call from this guy, this particular journalist, because he was looking for dirt wherever he could find it. She said, oh, yeah, he called, and we had a very nice talk. I said, really? I said, what did you say? She said, well, I told him you're always a good boy. Then you got in trouble for a while and were doing drugs. She asked about heroin. She said, yes. He was shooting heroin, but then he converted to Christ and changed his life overnight. And so proud of him, he worked his way through school and got a PhD. Anyway, he interviewed my mom, but could not get a single negative word to quote or a single contradictory story. This is my Jewish mom, proud of her son who, quote, converted to Christ and changed his life overnight. That's a big thing I got from my mom and my dad, too, that deep affirmation and really believing in me. We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, welcome to the Line of Fire. Michael Brown, so glad to be with you today, functioning, serving as your voice of moral sanity and spiritual clarity in the midst of a society in chaos and a church all too often in compromise. All right, I have often said that issues having to do with homosexual practice, with redefining marriage, are the offshoot of the counterculture revolution of the 1960s, which included the sexual revolution. In other words, they are not the offshoot of the civil rights movement, but rather the offshoot of the sexual revolution. And it's very easy to see when you look at polls, when you look at data. And I demonstrate this in great depth in my book that'll be out in September, Outlasting the Gay Revolution, Eight Principles for Long-Term Cultural Change. I demonstrate clearly that if you look at the polls, you'll see the same age groups or political affiliated people or demographically related people who have no real issue with, say, pornography, no real issue with cohabitation, people living together out of wedlock, people having kids together out of wedlock, who don't frown on polyamory the way others would. They're the same ones. The same ones who are much more sexually permissive. They are the same ones who have little or no problem with homosexual practice or with redefining marriage. In other words, it's part of the larger sexual anarchy of the culture. And conversely, those who say that marriage is the union of a man and a woman, as it has always been, those who say that homosexual practice is sinful, they will also say that sex out of wedlock in general is wrong, that fornication is wrong, that people living together out of wedlock is wrong, that having kids out of wedlock is wrong. And they will be more negative towards things like polyamory and adultery. Let me give an example of the sexual anarchy of our culture. This story is remarkable on every level. Unfortunately, it's not a surprise. This is IJReview.com, Katie Lapitin. The article is entitled, "You Must Be Naked. College Demands Students Flesh Out Final Exam Answers in Eye-Popping Way." A class at the University of California, no surprise, San Diego, takes the idea of showing up to class naked to a whole new level. Students in a visual arts class at the university are required to complete part of their final exam in the nude, or they will fail the entire class. So the mother of one of the students was quite outraged over this. Clip number one, Joey, and listen to what she tells her local TV, KGTV, as to her feelings about her daughter having to go to class, the last class in this course, go to the class naked. And this is part of what they're going to act out in the last class. Listen to what the mom says.
To blanketly say, "You must be naked in order to pass my class," it makes me sick to my stomach. There's a perversion going on here. Shame on him and shame on the university.
Yes, yes, yes to all that she said. It should make you sick to your stomach. It is a perversion. Shame on the professor. Shame on the university. Now hang on, though. Hang on. The plot thickens. Listen to what the professor, Roberto Dominguez, has to say. Oh, and by the way, he is naked also. How can you even imagine a university setting where the professor and all the students show up naked? And if you don't show up naked, you can't pass the course. Oh, of course, the room is dark and it's only candlelit. Why light up anything if you're trying to hide something? And if you're trying to hide something, why have everyone come in naked? Listen to what the professor has to say. Clip number two.
The art visual class at UCSD, according to the teacher, involves students acting out a series of gestures. The very last one they're asked to perform in the syllabus labeled erotic self. 10 News spoke to the professor, Ricardo Dominguez, by phone.
It's a standard canvas for performance art and body art.
It's true, he says, students have to be nude to pass the final. Nearly 20 students, everyone is naked, including him. What he calls a performance of self in a dark room lit only by candlelight.
It is all very controlled. If they are uncomfortable with this gesture, they should not take the class.
What idiocy. What moral idiocy. Here's the shocker, though. The class has been going on for 10 years. Is this the first parent to complain? Is this the first student to complain? I don't remember hearing about a complaint on this subject in years past. Parents in Boston recently, Massachusetts, were outraged when kids were given a survey. They were told there's going to be a survey for the kids, and it asked them questions, including things about is kids as young as 11, about carrying weapons or using drugs, or how many people have had sex with recently, and then list various types of sexual acts and ask, have they done this? One mother came in and said, my boy doesn't know what cocaine is. My boy doesn't know what these types of sex acts are. He's a boy, he's a child, and you're putting these surveys out. The point is, this is a season of sexual anarchy. The good news is that sexual purity trumps sexual anarchy. If we conduct ourselves with honor before the Lord, if we raise our families with honor, if we explain the purpose and beauty of sexual relations as God intended them, as we explain the misuse of these things and the destructive nature of these things, as we do that, then our families and our lives will reflect the blessing that comes through purity, the blessing that comes through long-term solid relationships. If you will look at those who have long-term committed solid relationships, man and woman who've been a committed, faithful marital relationship for decades, you will see overall, just on average, there are always exceptions to every rule, but on average, you will see greater emotional stability. And you'll even see over a period of years, again, on average, a higher general health quotient. Just like one study indicated that people who go to church on a regular basis, it's just this is all it was talking about. Obviously, you can qualify things based on what kind of churches if the survey is broken down. But just the general survey indicating that people that attended church regularly live longer than those who didn't. Now, could it be that those who attend church regularly have a little bit higher morals than those who don't attend regularly, and because of the higher morals, they're not drinking as much, they're not doing drugs as much, they're not engaging in dangerous behavior as much, they are not in involved in certain lifestyles that could produce shorter lifespan. That could be. It could also be the blessing that comes with knowing the Lord and the peace of heart and mind. But in the same way, you can extrapolate from that, and as other studies have indicated, that when there is marital stability and sexual faithfulness, that the overall emotional and physical health and well-being is increased, and then the health and well-being overall of the kids that are raised in an environment like that. The way that we push back against the anarchy is with purity. Not a legalistic thing that tries to change people from the outside in, that gives them unattainable standards while not touching their heart, but through a heart transformation and an embracing of the high standards of God, which we should rejoice in, not, I can't do this and I can't do that. That's just childishness. All it is childishness. That would be like me with the gracious intervention of God in my life to completely transform my relationship to food. So all kinds of stuff I ate all my life, I don't eat anymore. Then I only eat healthy stuff. And as a result of it, I'm in the best shape I've been in ages, and with the lowest cholesterol and blood pressure probably any time ever in my entire life. And here I am 60 years old and healthy and strong by God's grace.
Well, it would be like saying, I can't have peanut M&M's now. I can't have Ben and Jerry's New York.
No. I don't want that stuff. I had more than my share of it. I had enough to sink a big boat with all that I ate of it over the years. Maybe slight exaggeration, but maybe not that big an exaggeration. God's ways are better. For me, I'm just saying it's not God for me to eat those other things, but I'm talking about sexual purity. God's ways are better. When God spoke through Moses and said, choose life that you and your children may live. Choose life. How do you choose life? By obeying the commands of God. God's commands are life-giving and life-multiplying. We may lay our lives down as martyrs for the gospel, but God's ways, his commandments, are the way of life. We trump sexual anarchy by living in sexual purity.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Be sure to check out my latest articles. We published a few over the weekend. One came out on Friday. Don't tell me I'm overreacting. I'm talking about what's happening in society around us. And then a few called me cowardly. Oh, gosh. It's like saying, calling me cowardly is like saying I don't have a mustache or I don't like to talk. But anyway, a few people did because I said, hey, I defend Pam Geller's right to have the Muhammad cartoon contest and I applaud her courage, but it's something I wouldn't do because to me it would unnecessarily drive Muslims away from the gospel. But I said that wasn't her concern. She's Jewish and that wasn't her concern. I wrote an article about that, and I found something very dangerous in the way people were responding. That's one reason I wrote it. And then an article came out this morning, 4 Spiritual Lessons on the Mayweather-Pacquiao Fight, the so-called fight of the century, generated more money than any fight in boxing history by far, 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 far. And could net, $180 million for Mayweather and $120 for Pacquiao. Of course, much of his money he gives away to needy causes in the Philippines. But I posted those articles. To read them, go to Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org, and click on Latest Article. I think I'm going to write one tonight about Andy Stanley a little later in the broadcast. Somewhere over the next hour and a half or so, I'll interact with some recent Andy Stanley comments. But let me come back to the Massachusetts survey, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. For more, go to massresistance.com, M-A-S-S is in Massachusetts, massresistance.com, and you'll see the article. If there are little ones listening, you may just take a break for a minute or two, but this survey was given to students in middle school and high school, okay? Middle school and high school. How old are you? The answers range from 12 years old to 18 years old. Our two grandsons, cousins, 6 weeks apart, they're each 11 years old. Our oldest granddaughter, 14. So we've got kids on either side of this. Answers range from 12 years old at the youngest up to 18 years old. How old were you when you had sexual intercourse, oral, anal, vaginal, for the first time? The possible answers are never and 11 through 17. In the past 3 months, how many people have you had sexual intercourse with, oral, anal, vaginal? The possible answers range from 0 to 6. In the past 30 days, how many days did you carry a weapon? In the past 30 days, what's the largest number of drinks you had in a 4-hour period? Answers range from 1 or 2 to 10 or more. The questions about suicide, illegal drugs, and even whether your parents text while driving. You listen to some of the parents weighing in here, and they are absolutely and rightly outraged. This is part of the sexual anarchy of our culture today reflected in these very questions? All right, let me switch over to something else. And I realized what was happening. I realized what was happening with some of the people who were having this extreme reaction to the fact that I would dare differ on any level, that I would dare differ at all with the Muhammad cartoon contest, which I said again, I defended Pam Geller's right to have it. I understood she was having it in particular in the aftermath of the massacre of the Charlie Hebdo satirists. I understand the radical Islamic mentality we are dealing with. I'm all for confronting that. I do on a regular basis, to the consternation of some. And I said that I applauded her courage, but that to me it was something that unnecessarily provoked offense. That was my personal opinion. Now, some people reacted against me in really harsh terms and said, Dr. Brown, I'm so disappointed. I always support you. I can't believe you're taking the stand. And then they explained to me later that they were reacting as if I was joining the liberal media piling on and attacking Pam Geller. Actually, I didn't listen to any of those interviews. I had a couple of audio bites I played on the air, but that's it. I didn't follow. I knew what the liberal media was going to say, but I was not listening to it. I was not watching it on TV. I was not listening to it online. I was not reading it. I knew it would be out there. I saw the headlines, but that was it. So the idea that I was somehow joining in with them is completely ridiculous. Completely ridiculous. But what concerned me was this, that there was such a passionate solidarity with her that even someone like me, who has a track record of confronting radical Islam, who's had my Facebook page shut down because of posts about radical Islam, who's preached whole messages about this and done radio on this, and constantly I'm on the front lines risking a lot of things for speaking the truth in love, that I would now be branded cowardly. I could care less about how people misrepresent me or falsely accuse me. That happens day and night. But that they could be so caught up with this so as to have an irrational response, that's what concerned me. The inability to hear two sides of a story. The inability to reflect on something because the passions were so high and because the enemy was so bad. That is what concerned me. So take a look at the articles, in particular the cowardly one. I think you'll appreciate it overall, but that's what concerned me. And thankfully, I interacted with some who then apologized and said, hey, I misunderstood where you were coming from and I misread it. That is the concern. And, you know, it happens throughout social media, the headline mentality, the soundbite mentality. Boo, you hear that, you react. We got to do better than that. I'm sure I've been guilty of it, too, just an immediate reaction, like getting all the information. Okay, I've got some really neat news for you. How would you like to get a college-level class for, a dollar or two an hour? Yeah, I'm serious. Okay, when I led Messiah Biblical Institute in Maryland, which is a school that specialized in training people for Messianic Jewish ministry and then reached out to equip the whole body and have the whole body healthy and strong, I recorded a 12-hour class called The Messiah in Jewish Tradition. Who is the Messiah, not just according to the Bible, but in Jewish tradition? What did the Dead Sea Scrolls say about the Messiah? What about the Talmud? What about the idea that there'll be two Messiahs, the Messiah son of Joseph, the Messiah son of David? Where'd that come from? What about the end times, according to traditional Jewish teaching? It was a 12-hour lecture series, college level, but that anyone with an interest could follow. And then I put together a number of pages, a study guide, notes to go with it. Well, I don't believe we've ever offered this on the radio, and certainly not at this price. You can get the CD with the entire course, and then you just download the study guide online. Just $20, and we'll pay the postage. Yeah, for the 12-hour course. Or you can download it for just $15. Seriously. So call now 1-800-278-9978. 1-800-278-9978. You'll really enjoy this. Or go to my website, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org, for more info. This is Dr. Michael Brown, host of The Line of Fire. If you haven't been to AskDrBrown.org, what are you waiting for? There are hundreds of free audios, videos, articles to help equip you. And while you're there, check out the benefits of becoming a torchbearer, a monthly supporter of The Line of Fire. This week, we're giving all new torchbearers Let the Lion Roar, our special offer for the week. DVD, CD, CDs of interviews, and a book, more than a $40 value, all yours as you partner with us as a torchbearer. Together, we're making a difference.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks so much for joining us today on The Line of Fire. When I was on the road a few weeks ago in St. Louis, I had the pleasure of meeting a fellow radio host, Josh Tully. He's nationally syndicated, audience in all 50 states, 160 nations. A lot of his YouTube radio programs have gone viral. He's author of the book, Quit Your Job or Die. He's been a television anchor for presidential debate and ranked as a top 100 business trainer on Earth. I guess they have different business trainers for Mars and Pluto, but he's one of the top business trainers on Earth. And he's got a new book called Evangelopreneur. Yes, so you've got entrepreneur and evangelical in there. Evangelopreneur, how biblical free enterprise can empower your faith, family, and freedom. Josh and I got to spend some time together and had a lot of things in common and said, hey, listen, let's get on each other's show. So I'm going to be on Josh's show later in the week. It's my joy to welcome Josh to The Line of Fire. Hey, man, how you doing today?
Dr. Michael Brown, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. And I'm going to be one of the top trainers on Mars, too, if we ever colonize Mars.
All right. Excellent. Well, we will put that down. One of the top business trainers in the universe. Hey, Josh, when we were chatting, you mentioned to me that you're kind of an unlikely candidate to be doing what you're doing. How so?
Well, I think just the process of how I got here. You know, typically in America, we teach this system of go to school, get good grades, go to college, get more good grades, and then get a job in that trained profession. And I didn't go that course at all. Matter of fact, I did terribly in school, but I started my first business at 18, started the second one at 19. But when I graduated, I was so shy that I couldn't order a hamburger from McDonald's. If somebody rang the doorbell, I'd turn the lights off and hide. So the transition from where I was to where I am now has been nothing short of a work of God, to be honest with you.
So how did God help you get out of your shell and then go from one extreme to the other, but in a positive way?
It happened when I was sitting across the table from a couple in their mid-30s. Until that point, I was struggling with the shyness, and I was doing some things to get over it, and I started to have a little bit of success. And I was sitting across the table from this couple. They had a few kids. And we were developing this plan that they were actually working, and it was getting them into business, and it was changing their family, and they started crying. And I looked at them, and at the time I wasn't saved. I had no religious faith, and, you know, I was in my 20s, so I was in business for money and girls, you know. And I looked at them, and I said, why are you crying? And they said, we were praying for months for something. Something had to change. And that really was a pivotal moment. I could take you to that house still today, and we're almost 20 years on from that point. But I know where the house is. I know what color it is. And it was at that moment when I realized, hey, wait a second. Are there other people going to bed every night thinking, is this all my life is? And it was one of those life-changing moments that I started to pursue ways and means in order to help other people get past those objections. And then a few years later, it involved faith, and then, wow, I mean, that was really a game changer.
Got it. So the amazing thing is the shyness, all these other things in you had to do with you. But when you then realize that you could help others, got you out of your shell in a life-changing way, then you add God into the picture, and it's miraculous. The book, Evangelopreneur, the author, Josh Tully, T-O-L-L-E-Y. I'll tell you more about this when we come back.
The world.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Listen to what Rabbi Daniel Lapin says. By boldly brandishing the banner of faith in the arena of wealth creation, Tali, speaking of Josh Tali, describes the roadmap to real riches, valuable insights that will help the fiscal transformation of all readers. The book, Evangelopreneur, How Biblical Free Enterprise Can Empower Your Faith, Family, and Freedom. Josh, who did you write this book for?
I wrote it for every one of those families who goes to bed every night thinking, man, you know, how do we make ends meet? I wrote it for the people who have been walking in their faith, but yet unfortunately when it comes to money issues have been told either A, we ignore money completely in the church, or B, buy my $900 handkerchief and you'll become a millionaire. You know, the people of the faith are really caught between two stupid, really, positions. One where we say money's not that important, yet make sure you pay your tithe on Sunday. We say money's not that important, yet when your daughter says, you know, hey, Mom, I want to get married, what's the first question you ask? How are you going to take care of my daughter? Or we do some sort of weird prosperity gospel message. And the truth, the meat, the richness that's found in the Bible when it comes to how you're supposed to make money is just completely ignored because we think it's some sort of taboo topic. Yet the Bible talks more about money than it does heaven. It talks more about money than it does salvation. But even this conversation, I'll bet you dollars to donuts, is making some people feel uncomfortable because here we are talking about money, and that's why I wrote Evangelopreneur.
Right. We're talking about money on Christian radio, and isn't that part of the prosperity gospel? Actually, the idea that God blesses hard work and generosity and that God gives ideas for good business practices is thoroughly biblical, and it's just a matter of stewardship. The prosperity gospel that says Jesus died on the cross to make you financially rich and the proof of your spirituality is financial riches, of course, that's carnal and that's absurd. But the idea, the so-called Protestant work ethic, that's a matter of hard work, of diligence, of creative ideas from God, of generosity, and how that produces wealth. And then if we're good stewards, we use it wisely to help those in need, and to meet our own needs and to be able to finance the gospel around the world. Josh, if we had more funds for our ministry, we could be on more radio stations, we could send out more missionaries, we could reach more Jewish people, we could do a lot of good. So money itself can be powerfully used positively or negatively. In your book, though, it's not just a matter of theory. You lay out practical steps. So where does someone start? Where do you start them in the book, Evangelopreneur?
Well, first we start with talking about what money and the economy actually is. I have done a class for MBA students, and it was shocking to me how many of them never actually learned the foundational basics of what an economy is, or how there's actually multiple economies in the United States. We think there's only one. So we start there. We lay that framework so everybody has that same equal level playing ground. And then we start doing some evaluations. And the first thing is finding out what's important to you. I mean, you're going to work for 30, 40 hours a week working towards something. Statistically, we know that's not working. 4 out of 5 Americans are at or near poverty. 1 in 2 people don't have $500. So whatever most of us are doing, it's not working. So we start with examining that. Why are you going to work? What's the goal? What's the objective? Then once we have that laid out, we start putting together a framework or a plan that says regardless of where you are, whether you have no money at all or you have $2 million to invest, we can get you started in your own business. And really, when you look at the Bible, this modern version of employment isn't in there. Modern employment's a modern invention. In the Bible, you had masters, slaves, servants, and laborers. And none of those match what you're doing for 40 hours a week in most cases. So we reexamine that too. And by the time they get halfway through the book, there's this paradigm shift in how you perceive what you're doing with the majority of your time on earth.
Mm. All right. And folks, if you want to connect more with Josh, watch some of his videos, listen to his radio program, the website Josh Tolley, T-O-L-L-E-Y.com. What kind of responses have you gotten to readers of the book? Because I'm assuming that if somebody really understands the principles of the book, they might read it and enjoy it like a Rabbi Daniel Lapin did. But it's not something that they needed as much because they understood some of this. So a lot of the people reading it will be those who don't understand this and who maybe have been working faithfully for decades and have little to show for it. What kind of reports are you hearing from readers?
The response has been actually quite humbling. It's been one that has definitely let me know that this has been really touched by God. And I mean that in a very sincere way. I'm not saying it's the word of God or anything like that, but the way the Father is using the book to touch lives is amazing. I thought I was just going to write a book talking about how you can find entrepreneurship in the Bible. No big deal, right? But once it started getting out there into the marketplace, I started getting reports back of lives changing, marriages becoming better, parent-child relationships becoming better. We've even had people who've read the book come back and buy cases of the book just to give away to friends and family. It's been mind-blowing, the response to this so far.
Now, one thing for sure that we do have is the lack of a good biblical middle ground when it comes to finances. Not in all churches, but in many. Like you say, either we don't talk about it at all, or if we talk about it, we talk about it in the context of you know, just don't be greedy and things like that, or we just going to have some faith thing like, okay, this is the debt cancellation offering. And rather than learning principles of reducing debt, if I will now give to this guest speaker, you know, so that he can get a new Rolls Royce, then that somehow God's going to miraculously cancel out my debt. And man, I feel the spirit and anointing. And okay, it doesn't quite work like that. Why do you think that we just don't have a lot of savvy? Now, thank God for those that do, but so many in the body just don't have a lot of savvy when it comes to finances and work and this world. Why do you think that is?
Because we haven't been taught it. You know, when I go and speak, I bring with me a textbook from 1929. It's a seventh grade math textbook, and it's about an inch thick, and the first chapter is how to hire employees, second chapter is setting up distribution. We used to teach entrepreneurship as the default career. And a job was that thing you got if nothing seemed to work out and you had to have a fallback plan. Today, it's the exact opposite. Mm. And when it comes to understanding how we make money, I mean, just look at, for example, this movement through the church that said, well, all we need to do is get rid of debt and that makes us a good steward. It's false. It's a lie. Now, the people in the organizations that were promoting it, they didn't do anything unintentional, and I do not like debt. That's in the book. But getting out of debt is not enough because we have had a practical inflation rate of 10% since 1861, and I document that in the book, meaning if you're not getting a 10% raise every year at work, you're actually going backwards. So what happens is 10 years ago, everybody gets out of debt. They follow the get out of debt program that was sweeping through churches, and they ate the beans and rice. They got the extra jobs. And if their marriages happen to survive, if their kids happen to survive, and they got through that, which, by the way, is dangerous in and of itself, and they did pay off the debt, well, now they didn't increase their income. So 10 years later, that $50,000 a year is worth $25,000, which is why if you look back in time, your parents could buy a loaf of bread for 5 cents. You're buying it for $2. And if 3% a year was true, it would still be under a buck. So we really have to break down that lie and say, if you're going to be a good financial steward, you almost have to be an entrepreneur. And when you look at the example of Jesus in the parable about the people with the talents, we're actually worse than the guy who buried it. We buried it, and then we paid rent on the land that we buried it on. We're going backwards so fast.
Mm. Not the greatest testimony there. But again, a lot of it is ignorance. A lot of it, people are well-meaning and working hard, and a lot of this is ignorance. The book, Evangelopreneur, How Biblical Free Enterprise Can Empower Your Faith, Family, and Freedom. We come back. I just want to ask Josh a couple more questions in the time we have. One of them is a question he asks on page 83 of his book. Is our approach to work any different than a non-believer's? You say, well, yeah, I mean, we're honest on the job, and maybe some non-believers wouldn't be. And And, you know, we work faithfully and, okay, amen to that. But could it be that there is more? What's the difference between a believer and a non-believer? And then, Josh, if you're just going to be coaching someone, you're a life coach, business coach. Right now it's on Earth because we haven't populated Mars yet. If you missed that, go back a few minutes and listen. But we'll talk about that. Just fundamental. If you get instill any one thing in someone, a worker, a laborer, to change their thinking, what would it be? Visit Josh at joshtolley, TOLLEY.com. We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us on the Line of Fire. You're a listener-sponsored voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown speaking with radio host, author, and entrepreneur Josh Tolley. His new book, Evangelopreneur, How Biblical Free Enterprise Can Empower Your Faith, Family, and Freedom. And on page 83 of the book, there's a question. Is our approach to work any different than a non-believer's? Josh, that question might surprise some because you're not just talking about not cheating and being honest and hardworking. You're talking about some bigger issues. Could you open that up for us?
Oh, absolutely. I think when it comes to work and our belief, we seem to check it at the door. And when you look at stats, you know, I happen to be friends with George Barna, who started the Barna Group. And when you look at the stats of believers who spread their faith, the least that they spread their faith happens to be at work. So First, there's a huge red flag there, yet people constantly tell you, well, God wants me to be here, God wants me to be here. And it's interesting, you know, because work is the place of most affairs. It's the cause of most divorces. It's the cause of most deaths. You're telling me God wants all these bad things. And in the book, we list about 15 or so of those bad things that typically come from employment. And we explain why that's not the design. But going beyond that, are we working like non-believers? When you look at the Western world, the number one pain happens to be financial. Now, should it be? No. I get it. There are far more important things than money. But It happens to be financial. When we have more people filing for bankruptcy than graduating college, when 4 out of 5 Americans are at or near poverty, it's a huge problem. So they come into the church, and they come from a world that has employment for 40 hours a week. They have college loan debts. They have car payments, credit card payments, mortgages on their home, 401ks, both parties in the house working. They come into the church saying, okay, I'm going to get out of the world system. Obviously, the Bible has answers to all of my hurts, including money. What do they hear for their number one hurt? Work for 40 or 50 hours a week, have your spouse do the same, get the college loan payment, get the credit card, get the car refinanced. They hear the exact same stuff, and then they leave the church. And I get it. There's wonderful stuff in the faith to do with salvation and eschatology and all that sort of thing, but they don't stick around long enough to experience it because we're not meeting their number one need. Right or wrong, it's still their number one need right now. And in the Bible, we constantly see the example of Jesus feeding them before he preaches to them, healing them before he preaches to them. And there's a reality to that, that we as believers, we're missing the number one opportunity to evangelize in the Western world when we don't understand what's an evangelpreneur.
Yeah, and you know, as I've been flipping through the book more since you gave it to me, and then just in breaks in the interview, even some of the lies that you deal with, just don't have time to get into all of it. So, friends, get the book. You can get it online, Amazon or different book dealers. Evangelopreneur, the author Josh Tolley, TOLLEY. All right, Josh, I had a ton of questions I want to ask. I've only got time for one more. If you were sitting down with somebody, obviously every situation is different. But sitting down with a believer that's in the business world, and you're gonna start coaching, if you're just going to go in cold and there's one thing you want to get in this person's mind, what would it be?
Well, I would ask them, can they accomplish what God wants them to do in their life by doing what they're doing? How many people have died, have been put into their grave, missing the opportunity of being the person God wanted them to be? Somebody once told me, Josh, wouldn't it be terrible that if in hell you met the person you could have been? And that's the first thing I would start with. What did God put you on this planet to do? And more times than not, and it's pretty simple, if you ask somebody, if you had 3 years to live and $100 million, would you still be working the job you work? And if the answer is no, then you're doing the wrong thing. And it has nothing to do with the money. It has to do with what time and control of finances allows you to do. So we would start with that gut check, find out what their calling in life is, and there's a three-step process that I use to determine that in people's lives, and then create a plan to get them to that. Too often, we work to pay bills as opposed to work to accomplish whatever the goal is. And once you change that equation, it's amazing what you can accomplish.
Yeah, this is very heavy stuff, friends. Very, very heavy and potentially life-changing. We only have so much time with Josh. Obviously, you can catch up with a lot more of his material on his website, JoshTolley, TOLLEY.com. You can watch his viral YouTube videos, listen to his radio program. But right now, best thing to do is get his book, Evangelopreneur, How Biblical Free Enterprise Can Empower Your Faith, Family, and Freedom. Josh, it's been a delight talking with you, and look forward to joining you on your show later in the week.
Thank you, sir. I look forward to the same.
All right. Thanks so much. All right. That's some stirring, heavy stuff to think about and to consider. And I would dare say it challenges many of our paradigms. There's a verse in Proverbs I'm looking for that Josh quotes in his book. It's Proverbs 13:22. In Hebrew, it's very concise. Tov yanchil v'nei vanim v'tzafun l'tzadik chel chotei, which is generally translated, the good man leaves an inheritance to his grandchildren, but the wealth of a sinner is stored up for the righteous. And I'm thinking in terms of the larger gospel work that we do, the way that we live, the way that we conduct ourselves as families. Are we leaving an inheritance to our grandchildren? What kind of world are we leaving to our children and our grandchildren? What kind of moral society are we leaving to our children and grandchildren? Based on our handling of things today, what kind of world are we turning over to our kids and grandkids? Our daughters now, 37 and 36, our grandkids, 14 and 11, girl, boy, and then 11 and 8, boy, girl, and they love me and Nancy dearly. We have wonderful, close relationships, and obviously they are following, by God's grace, in our footsteps in the faith and in morality. Our older daughter was talking to Nancy a few years ago and just said, I'm so glad you raised me the way you did. She would have gotten in a whole lot of trouble otherwise. And of course, our kids feel deeply about the things we feel deeply about in terms of our grandkids, the truths of God and moral living. But there's a responsibility we have beyond our own family. There's a responsibility we have for the generations to come at large. How are we living today? How is it going to affect them tomorrow? All right. As soon as you have about a minute and a half, 2 minutes, go to my website, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. Right on the homepage, you'll see this week's special offer. Do you think it's important to know what Jews believe about the Messiah? Do you think it's important to find out what Judaism has taught about this through the centuries? This is a college-level 12-hour class that I recorded some years ago, and the first time we're releasing it like this comes with a short study guide as well, with essential terms and notes and facts and further information. You can get it on CD or download for an unbelievably low price. So check it out at Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. My bottom line today, it's not only a question of the way we live today, does it make sense in the light of eternity? But the way we live today, will it make sense to future generations? You know, I think of Mother's Day, I'm reminded that kids really deserve a mom and a dad. And by the way, Andy Stanley said some controversial things this week, but I agree. in part.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
You want to hear a nice story? Something that will encourage you and bless you on this day after Mother's Day. Michael Brown, welcome to the broadcast, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884, to get involved in the conversation today. At the half-hour mark, we'll be bringing on a special guest to talk about a new book, Crimes of the Educators. Ooh, that sounds disturbing. We'll be talking about that, and a heartwarming story I want to share with you in a moment. But first, Joey, grab clip number three. The results of the elections in England, a big, big surprise, a strong conservative victory. And one of the parliamentary members who was ousted, George Galloway, while he denies being an anti-Semite, is as anti-Zionist as any politician in the West I can think about, and you could make a good case for his anti-Semitism as well, in my humble opinion. But he was voted out. There's some scandals associated with him as well. I don't know if they're accurate or not. I think certain things are not in dispute. Of course, he says that he's just going to prepare for his next campaign. But clip number three, this is how biased and ugly this man is in his comments towards Israel and the Jewish people. Listen to what he had to say.
So I don't begrudge the Labour members here their moment of celebration, of course. But there will be others who are already celebrating. The venal and the vile, the racists and the Zionists, we'll all be celebrating.
Ah. Did you hear that? Venal, vile, these base people celebrating that he's out. And in that list, Zionists. Zionists. How pathetic. Pathetic to think he was ever elected in the first place. May God have mercy on him and bring him to repentance. Okay. Oh, by the way, I may be bringing on my guest earlier to talk about Crimes of the Educators. There's a woman named Joanne who, although a single woman, has been a mother to many in Nigeria. Some years ago, she attended a debate that I did in Maryland at the home of a Russian Messianic Jew. And she, at that time, was a staunch counter-missionary living as an Orthodox Jewish woman. She had renounced faith in Jesus, was living as an Orthodox Jewish woman, and came along to this debate. I didn't know I was debating Rabbi Tovia Singer. Sadly, he has refused to debate me for over 20 years now. I often get asked about debating him. I said, of course I would, in a heartbeat, but he's refused to debate me for over 20 years and requested that the private tapes we had from that night not be distributed. And we had honored that. That's before he had said he would never debate me and then went back on something else. But we had honored that and never released those tapes. In any case, Joanne was there, was so shaken by that evening that began a journey for her where she recovered and found in a deeper way faith in Jesus the Messiah. And she's since, in recent years, sold everything as a woman in her 50s, gone over to Nigeria in settings, in situations that you and I probably wouldn't make it for a few days. She lives there, and she's become a mother to the children there, teaching, training, and just sending a praise report. She was able to buy chairs for some of these learning challenge kids that she teaches, and what a joy. She's become a mother of many. Send it, Lord.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
In the last hour, I made reference to sexual anarchy, even in our schools. I referenced a university in California where for a particular class, students had to come in the nude, and the professor would be in the nude. And the class had been going on for 10 years, and apparently it was now the first time I was aware of where someone complained about it. I mentioned a survey given out to children as young as 11 years old or 12 years old, so middle school age in Massachusetts, that had parents outraged with the questions the kids were being asked. But that's kind of just a symptom of a much, much bigger problem. And I have on the air with me now Alex Newman, together with Samuel Blumenfeld. They've co-authored a new book, Crimes of the Educators, How Utopians Are Using Government Schools to Destroy America's Children. And right on the cover of the book, a former congressman, presidential candidate Ron Paul says a compelling case that America's public education system must undergo radical change. Alex, thanks so much for joining us today on The Line of Fire.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let me ask a question that many would wonder about just with the title and subtitle. Are you and Dr. Blumenfeld just some conspiracy theorists that have very little background in these areas? On what basis do you and Dr. Blumenfeld make such comments? Tell me about your background and the background of Dr. Blumenfeld, because what you say in the book is very, very strong.
Sure. Thank you so much for the opportunity. Actually, we were not making up any theories. And actually, what we did for the book was document everything with primary sources so people can hear it right from the horse's mouth, the people who designed this system. But there's no question that the claim sounds humongous. Is the education establishment committing crimes? We argue that yes, they are. And the book explains why. And we argue that they're literally destroying America's children. And again, we have the primary source documents to back all this up. Now, as for our background, Dr. Blumenfeld has been studying and writing on education matters for more than 40 years. He's written about 10 books so far on education. And he really has been kind of a pioneer in uncovering the lunacy, absolute lunacy and criminality that's going on in the government education system. As for me, I'm a little bit newer at this. I'm still in my 20s, but I've been writing on education for about 5 years now, a little bit longer. And I focused mostly on Common Core and where this was all going. Dr. Blumenfeld, his research focused more on how did we get to this point. And so he has done really the original research on John Dewey, for example, the founding father of quote-unquote progressive education, which is what we have across this country at this point. I'm also a teacher. I teach at a private school, and I've been very interested in education as far back as I can remember. And so, but it's not about what we think, what our opinion is. What it's about is the facts are there. The documentation is there. These people have said what they're doing. They've told us what they're doing. We know what they're doing. And this is criminal, and it needs to be exposed.
Yeah, and by the way, just going through some of the chapter titles and the content of the book, this is one of these awakening, shaking-type books that really shows us how skewed things are today. Let's just say a kid was studying in an American school 200 years ago. Would it have been that much different than a kid studying in a school today? Have things really changed that dramatically?
Oh, it's night and day. Actually, if you go back to the early America, even back to the colonies, the first law on education we had, the old Deluder Satan Act. So everybody needed to learn how to read because everybody needed to know their Bible because otherwise Satan was going to come around and get up to no good. So everybody needed to know scripture. So that's originally why the emphasis on education. This was passed in the Massachusetts Bay Colony in the 1600s. We didn't really have any kind of education system as we know it today until Horace Mann came along and brought the Prussian model. So the Prussians had created this authoritarian mandatory compulsory school system where students were segregated by age and were expected to learn obedience to the state and loyalty to the state. And so Horace Mann, he was the first ever Secretary of Education that we had in the United States. He served in Massachusetts as the Secretary of Education for the state of Massachusetts. And he brought this system in. So what we know today as schools, that didn't really exist in the United States until Horace Mann brought this over here. Before that, schooling was largely the responsibility of parents and churches and ministers. And occasionally they would set up, you know, like a one-room school where students from, you know, 7 years old to maybe 13, 14 years old would all learn together. But frankly, education back then was infinitely better. I mean, John Adams, our one of our first presidents, said, an American who can't read is as rare a spectacle as an earthquake or a comet. So everybody could read back then. Most of them could read, you know, Latin, Greek. Everybody was very well educated back then without a government system. And today, the federal government's own numbers show that 55% of Americans can barely read, yet we're spending $1 trillion or more on education. So clearly something has gone majorly wrong, and what we try to do in the book is show what that is.
All right, so let's start at the beginning. Your very first chapter, Treason, the Deliberate Dumbing Down of a Nation. Now, Alex, to be totally clear, I've asked you to come on the air because I'm intrigued by the larger thesis, and I know that things are fundamentally wrong, and I want you to talk about it. So I'm going to play the devil's advocate, simply to play the devil's advocate, not because I believe what I'm saying, but to play the devil's advocate here, because we haven't talked before this. So, I'm certainly speaking for others. What? Come on. The deliberate dumbing down of a nation? It's one thing to say, you know, we've gotten top heavy with governmental involvement and we haven't made the right choices and maybe our structure of having 20 or 30 kids all squeezed together and everybody at the same level. And, you know, maybe that's not the best way and maybe homeschooling is a good innovation and we can. But the deliberate dumbing down of a nation, why would anyone, government or otherwise within a country, want to dumb down a whole nation?
Excellent question, and I'm glad you're playing devil's advocate because this gives a good chance to kind of dig into this and explain. So we start the book with John Dewey. Now, John Dewey, again, was the founding father of the educational model that we have today in this country. But most people don't know much about him. Most people have not gone back and read his writings. He was extremely clear in what he wanted to do. He wanted to turn America into a socialist, communist, collectivist utopia. And he said so himself. This was no secret. This is in all his writings. It permeates everything he did. He went to the Soviet Union to study their school system and thought it was spectacular that they're turning out little collectivists. Now, he wanted a uniquely, quote-unquote, American brand of socialist tyranny here. He pointed to a novel published in 1888 by Edward Bellamy. Almost nobody knows of it today, but it was quite influential in its day, called Looking Backward. And it was a fantasy of a communist America in the year 2000 where there was no private property. Everything was for the, quote-unquote, common good. And, you know, you've probably heard that saying before from mass murderers and dictators and other assorted criminals and tyrants. And so he was very clear in that he wanted to turn America into a socialist country. And his chief method for achieving that was taking over the education system. He knew that as long as Americans were extremely literate, we were the most literate society in history on the planet up until that point. So he set out to deliberately destroy the literacy of the American people. And his main mechanism for doing that was promoting something that was already known to be quackery at the time. This is the whole word method, the look-say method, the sight method of learning how to read. This was developed in the 1830s by a reverend who wanted to teach deaf children how to read, and they couldn't understand the sounds because they couldn't hear. So he said, maybe we can get them to learn it kind of like Chinese. They'll look at the word as a symbol and just memorize what the symbol means. So you just have to memorize each word and what it means. Now, you know, it might be okay for deaf people, but we have a phonetic alphabet. And so since time immemorial, the way you teach a phonetic alphabet is using intensive systematic phonics. You have to know what sound a letter makes so that you can decipher what the letters mean together and form a word and then form a sentence and so on. And he set about trying to get this quackery called the whole word method introduced in every teaching college in this country. He had a lot of money from the Rockefellers and other sources, and they took over the teaching colleges, and this is what they're using today in government schools across the country. That's why Johnny can't read. And this was all part of his plan to turn America into a socialist country. And, of course, he had a lot of collaborators, but he was really the ringleader. And so that's why we start off the book focusing on him. Now, as to the claim of treason, you know, that might sound like a, you know, a big deal, but Ronald Reagan put together an the National Committee on Excellence in Education in 1983. They produced a report, and, you know, government committees, they don't normally use strong or incendiary language, but they said, you know, this is so bad. If a foreign power had imposed this educational system on the United States, we would have viewed it as an act of war. And what Sam and I say is, hey, this is an act of war. You're deliberately dumbing down an entire nation for the purpose of overthrowing its constitutional system of government. That sounds like treason to me.
And listen, friends, if you genuinely disagree based on your information or knowledge or research with what Alex Newman is saying, you can call in. But I am listening with very, very open ears. 866-34-TRUE, the book, Crimes of the Educators.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I am speaking with Alex Newman, together with Samuel Blumenfeld, Dr. Samuel Blumenfeld. They have authored a very controversial and cutting-edge and eye-opening book, Crimes of the Educators, How Utopians Are Using Government Schools to Destroy America's Children. Phyllis Schlafly, president of Eagle Forum, says this: Crimes of the Educators by Samuel Blumenfeld and Alex Newman is must reading for every parent. The failure to teach children to read in the first grade means that they fall further behind with each passing year and become bored and resentful of school. The title of this book used the word crimes. That is not too strong a word to describe what has been done to American children. Alex, in the fourth chapter of the book, 31 chapters in all, you ask the question, how dumbed down are we? Well, we sometimes hear about a college athlete that managed to, maybe a top football player, that now confesses while they're in the pros, you know, I never learned to read. And we think, okay, that's obviously some rare exception where you had some athletically gifted kid that just got pushed ahead and people did the work for him. That is obviously extreme to be in college and not able to read. But how dumbed down are we?
You know, it's actually much less extreme than people might think. The literacy numbers in this country have been plunging ever since Dewey and his cohorts got their greedy little mitts on our educational system. And again, this was by design. But Sam and I examined all kinds of different lines of evidence to try to look at how dumbed down have we become as a nation. And it's just absolutely shocking, and it boggles the mind, really. I mean, one of the things that I did, for example, I went back and looked at all, you know, the eighth grade tests they were using back around the year 1900. I guarantee you 95% of college graduates today would not perform satisfactorily on these tests. They wouldn't be familiar enough with the English language and the rules of grammar. They wouldn't be decent enough at math. They wouldn't know the history. They wouldn't know the science. And that's saying something, because these were eighth grade tests. I mean, that's, you know, a lot of students just went up to the eighth grade. And these kids that were graduating from the schools more than 100 years ago were better educated than a lot of college graduates today. I can say it without a doubt. Then we have, you know, just the objective data. We can look at, for example, SAT scores going back into the 50s. Every 10 years or so, the people that run the SAT, it's the College Board now, in David Coleman, the architect of Common Core, is now in charge of it. Every 10 years or so, they have to dumb down the test. They call it recentering because they want the average to stay at about 500. But the problem is the students are getting dumber and dumber and dumber and dumber. So the scores are going down. And we're at the point today now where the really smart kids are almost dumber than the dumb kids of 50 years ago. And so we are in you know, a downward spiral when it comes to education. And we're at such a point now that, you know, it literally threatens the future of our nation and our freedoms. And Ronald Reagan's commission said the same thing. Our future as a people and as a nation is in jeopardy because of how dumbed down we have become as a direct result of the government education system.
So when you add into this the whole social media frenzy, the texting, soundbiting mentality of this generation, and things have to be reduced to tweetable comments, and the inability to think things through and digest, and how much more distracted we are, That really is a recipe for disaster. And friends, even if you don't think there's a conspiracy, all right, your average school teacher is obviously not trying to uneducate kids. What you can't deny is the overall fruit of the system. But again, play the devil's advocate here. Are you blaming the schools on the rise of dyslexia? Isn't it we just better understand it now? Before we didn't understand it, now we do. You seem to be blaming the school system as if the school is responsible, our education system, for dyslexia.
It absolutely is, actually, and we have the scientific evidence to back it up. Now, with modern brain scans, we can show that this quack method of teaching students to read, or actually preventing them from learning to read, is probably a more accurate way to describe it, produces actual physical brain damage. So if you do two brain scans, one on a kid who learned how to read the correct way with phonics, which is, again, you know, very simple, very easy, you can teach a four-year-old to do it with $15, their brain will be working properly. They'll have all the connections between the right and the left side. Everything will be working just as it should be. If you do the same brain scan on someone who learned to not read using this quack methodology that Dewey and his cohorts promoted, you'll see that they have all kinds of malfunctions. They have parts that aren't as active as they should be. They don't have the connections between the two spheres. And so they're literally producing physical brain damage in the children. Now, Sam and I both make the case that teachers are not to blame here. You know, everybody likes to hate on the teachers. I'm a teacher. You know, there's no reason to hate on the teachers. Most of them went through college education colleges, and they got a degree from some PhD person who told them this is how you teach kids to read. You have to show them words as if they're pictures. And so they're just as much victims as the students here. And we try to make that really clear here. This is not an attack on the teachers. The teachers' unions, yeah, that's another matter. We can save that discussion for another time. But, you know, no teacher goes into education to deliberately dumb down children. It's ludicrous. People who go into education do so because they love learning, they love children, they want to raise up a next generation that's going to understand things. Nobody goes into it saying, I'm going to dumb down the children. And you know, that's where we're at, unfortunately. The teachers, by and large, don't realize the damage that they're inflicting on students. And now some of them are becoming aware, especially with Common Core. But, you know, we're really hoping teachers will read this book. They need to, because they're unwittingly participating in the dumbing down of our children.
All right. The name of the book, Crimes of the Educators. Get a copy. You won't be disappointed. And again, primary sources, that means not just quoting somebody said something about somebody else or something else, actual quotes from the people themselves, the shapers, the movers of the educational system. Crimes of the Educators, How Utopians Are Using Government Schools to Destroy America's Children, co-authored by Samuel Blumenfeld and my guest, Alex Newman. We just have, tell you what, if you can stay on a little longer, I've got a bunch more questions for you, Alex. So stay right there.
Sure.
But so everybody, so you know what's coming, friends. We'll talk about ADD, ADHD, and does that have anything to do with our current educational system? There's all, well, chapters on destroying a child's religious beliefs, a spiritual crime, the unsettling phenomenon of teen suicide, and the making of the black underclass, eugenics, and the creation of the black underclass. This is not blaming black America. This is blaming others for crimes against black America. Get a copy of the book, Crimes of the Educators, Samuel Blumenfeld and my guest, Alex Newman. So I've got a bunch more questions for Alex on the other side of the break. And friends, as we do our best to educate and equip, you can now get a college-level 12-hour class that I did on the Messiah in Jewish tradition for, I don't know, less than you probably get a couple of Big Mac meals for your family. Get the whole college-level class, just barely a dollar or two per hour on CD or download, together with a study guide that will help you go through the class. All kinds of questions you probably wondered about and information you never knew existed about what Jewish people through the centuries have believed about the Messiah. It will engage you, eye-opening, and it doesn't require any Hebrew background. We take you through the relevant texts. To order, call 1-800-278-9978. That's 1-800-278-9978 or go to my website, AskDrBrown.org. We'll tell you more about the material right there.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Talk about pulling no punches. Samuel Blumenfeld and my guest, Alex Newman, in their book, Crimes of the Educators, begin with this line: progressive utopians are criminals, exclamation point. They're genocidal psychopaths who've killed more human beings in the last 100 years than any other ideologues in history. They don't limit their murder just to individuals, but to entire nations, as in National Socialist Germany's war of extermination against the Jews, the Soviet Union's war against anti-communists, Cambodia's slaughter of the educated middle class, and communist China's cultural war. And yet, the authors claim that there is a similar mentality, but fought with different weapons, in the dumbing down of our educational system. The book, Crimes of the Educators. Alex, at the beginning of your book, you have a dedication to a number of different individuals. One of them is John Taylor Gatto, obviously very well known in the homeschooling movement. But I picked up one of his books. It's not an area I read in a lot. And he was talking about some of the most influential people in our society, be they entrepreneurs, be they leaders in the tech industry, whoever they are. And some of them had an education that only went partly through elementary school. Some of them, they dropped out of high school. Some dropped out of college. What is it that John Taylor Gatto says that you agree with, and one of the reasons you dedicated the book to him?
He is such an interesting man, and this is partly because he came from within the belly of the beast. He really excelled at what he was doing. He was, New York State Teacher of the Year, who knows how many times. He was a super well-respected, award-winning teacher. And then one day he said, no, I'm not going to do this anymore. The schools are dumbing down the children. They're treating them as animals that need to be conditioned. They're brainwashing them with faulty information, false religion, and I'm not going to participate in this anymore. And so he did the world a humongous service by exposing all of this from the inside, from the perspective of somebody who's lived it, who's done it. And I mean, we quote him fairly extensively in the book because he just has so much insight into the damage that these schools are doing to children that, he's really, his contributions to the education movement are just invaluable.
Wow. All right, friends, all in the book, Crimes of the Educators. We've just got 2 minutes for this, but ADD, ADHD, are you blaming all of that or a lot of that on the school system, and then our solution is to drug the kids? I mean, isn't this kind of an outrageous claim, isn't it?
No, actually, we think it's right on the money, and the schools are sometimes deliberately, sometimes not, but they're damaging the children. And when the children can't, for example, learn how to read, they're teaching them with this quack method, then they feel stupid. They don't like school. They don't want to participate. So they act out. They can't sit in class and be still. And then the solution to that, at least according to the education establishment, is to pump them full of dangerous amphetamine drugs. These are hardcore drugs that they're filling the kids with, and they're misdiagnosing the problem. So, the education system is not entirely to blame for this. There's other vested interests at work. The big pharmaceutical companies obviously have an interest in pumping these drugs out. Psychiatry has, an interest. But the schools are a huge part of the problem. And people need to understand, too, that ADD and ADHD, these are not objective medical diagnoses. This isn't like you break a bone, you get an X-ray, and then you have a broken arm. Or, you go to the doctor and they do a blood test and then they see that you have some kind of problem. When we're talking about ADD and ADHD, these are diseases that psychiatrists literally invented. They voted to create these diseases and provide a list of symptoms. And the diagnoses are, not based on objective criteria. But the symptoms that are associated with these diseases are absolutely 100% attributable to what's going on in the schools.
All right. Strong claims from co-author Alex Newman, together with Samuel Blumenfeld, wrote the book Crimes of the Educators. Some of you are listening and saying this all makes sense. Some of you are outraged. Get the book. We haven't even touched Common Core. but I want to talk about the attack on religion and the attack on Black America in the schools.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to the Line of Fire. Talk about a lively, cutting-edge interview. My guest, Alex Newman, together with Dr. Samuel Blumenfeld, they have written Crimes of the Educators, How Utopians Using Government Schools to Destroy America's Children. If you're just tuning in, I am playing the devil's advocate in this interview, not challenging my guest as much as setting him up to respond to challenges that he and his co-authors certainly knew they would run into. Well, the idea that religion is being attacked in the schools, come on, we have separation of church and state. And how would we feel if Muslim teachers were teaching about Islam in our schools, or Jewish teachers were telling Christian kids why they don't believe in Jesus? I mean, look, kids just get moral education. Well, they shouldn't even get moral education. They just get education about facts and information and history in the school. So how can you say there's some kind of attack on religion in the school system? And hang on.
That's a big myth of...
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, okay, excellent question. And there is this big myth out there that the schools are, you know, secular, and they're supposed to keep religion and schooling separate. But I think what fewer people realize is that the schools are actually teaching a religion. It's just not the correct religion. It's just not the Christian religion that really formed the basis of the foundation of this country. If you look back at the educational history of America, education always, since the first colonists got here until about the middle of the 19th century, was always aimed at making sure kids could read the Bible. That was the main purpose of education. And if you could read the Bible, you could read everything else. Today, that's very different. Now, John Dewey, we talked about John Dewey earlier, kind of the architect of today's government education system. He had a religion, too. It just wasn't Christianity. He was one of the signers of the first Humanist Manifesto. And people think, oh, well, humanism isn't a religion. Well, read the first Humanist Manifesto and then tell me that again. The very first plank of the Humanist Manifesto that John Dewey signed, which he wanted to promote throughout all the government schools in this country, was... we do not believe God created the world. The universe is self-existing. Were the first words in the Bible. In the beginning, God created. So they could not have. It could not have been a more direct challenge to the truth, to the objective fact. Now, beyond that, the schools are not just indoctrinating the kids into a false religion. They're doing everything they can to undermine the Christian religion, and only the Christian religion. If you take a look, for example, one of the things that we focus on a fair amount, not too much, but we do talk about it a good amount, is the indoctrination of students into believing evolution, this secular notion of evolution, that it rained on the rocks and the rocks came alive and it turned into soup, and then the soup turned into a monkey and that turned into a human. Now, that might sound like, okay, you know, that's science. Well, maybe you went to a government school. First of all, that's not supported by the evidence. Second of all, that provides an entire world view. First of all, they've attacked the authority of Scripture. They've undermined the book of Genesis, and therefore, if you believe the evolution theory, you don't believe the Bible. Second of all, they use this to instill a radical new set of values in the students. They tell them, you know, you're just an animal, you came from slime, your life is no more valuable than that of a goldfish, there is no right and wrong, humans get to decide what is moral and what is not moral. So they're teaching a religion in the schools. It's just not the religion of the vast, overwhelming majority of the American people, and it's not the religion that this country was founded on.
All right. So, again, find similar attacks on Islam or Buddhism or Hinduism or Judaism in the books or in the spirit and attitude of the teachers that you find about Christianity. Alex, in terms of Black America, what are you saying in this book? Has there been some type of conspiracy to keep Black Americans down, to keep them uneducated? Is there cultural sensitivity towards Black Americans and recognize that growing up, they, you know, they may have different language, eugenics, and, you know, in their or ebonics, excuse me, you know, and we just need to understand these things and cater to them? Or is there a real attack on Black America, not just in the Planned Parenthoods and the Margaret Sangers of this world, but in the educational system?
Excellent, excellent question. And there absolutely is. One of the things that we show in the book is that John Dewey surrounded himself with eugenicists and behavioral psychologists. And at the time, the progressive movement had started to believe that racism was scientific. They believed that science showed whites to be superior and blacks to be inferior. Now, of course, this is all quackery, and we discussed this in the book, that this was based on absurd experiments, and sometimes they would draw the opposite conclusion of what the evidence would show just to promote their racism. But John Dewey was surrounded by eugenicists, and the people who came after him were, by and large, eugenicists. And a eugenicist is somebody who believes, first of all, in the evolution theory, and they believe that we need to improve the human race through what they call eugenics, basically selective breeding. And, you know, people like Margaret Sanger, she's quite well known. She wanted to exterminate, her words, the Negro race, and she didn't want them to find out about it. She wanted to exterminate all the human weeds out there. But Margaret Sanger was not alone. She was a product of the progressive movement, and John Dewey's cohorts were absolutely demonstrably eugenicists. We have their own writing showing that they were eugenicists. And so as eugenicists, they didn't believe that blacks needed to procreate. They didn't believe blacks needed a proper education. And so they relegated them to even worse education than what they were planning for the whites. And the results of this are very easy to demonstrate. We can show after slavery, the literacy of black Americans was skyrocketing to the point where only like 25% were illiterate in the early 20s, early 30s. After John Dewey and his criminals got a hold of the education system and started the dumbing down, now black illiteracy is estimated at more than 50% of the population. So how did they go from skyrocketing upwards to plummeting downwards into the situation that we have now? And the answer is quite simple. It was by design. Now, you mentioned the word conspiracy, and it's an interesting word. It kind of evokes like a Pavlovian reaction from a lot of people. You hear the word, you suddenly tune out. It's an interesting word, and Sam and I talked for quite a while about whether it's applicable to this, because there's three elements in a conspiracy. The first is it has to be secret. Now, this is not very secret. We have the documents firsthand. We republish some of them in the book. We cite them in the bibliographies. People can go and find this. This isn't secret information. It has to be more than one person. This certainly fits that criteria. And it has to have an evil, illegal, or immoral intent. And this certainly fits that criteria. So whether it's a conspiracy or not hinges on the secrecy component of it. We found the information, so it wasn't that secret. And, you know, people can decide for themselves whether they want to use that word for what's going on here or not, but it is certainly a criminal enterprise with very evil goals.
Got it. Very clear. And when you make the strong claims that you make in the book, and you tell us that you carefully considered the words that you used, that means there's got to be a tremendous amount of evidence. Things did not just happen on their own. Last question. We've got about 2.5 minutes. Common Core. What's so bad about Common Core?
It's almost the opposite question, right? What's not so bad about Common Core? That would be a much shorter list. Common Core is a monstrosity from top to bottom. First, I'll hit three of the main points. Obviously, you know, we could go on this for days. First of all, federal intrusion and global intrusion into local schools. Now, schools, if we're going to have government schools, ought to be controlled by the communities that fund them, school districts, taxpayers in the local community. So this is completely stripping our ability to control our schools and handing it over to unaccountable, unelected bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. That's unacceptable. Second of all, the standards are terrible. The Common Core people themselves put together a validation committee. They thought it was going to be like a rubber stamp committee just to, you know, put the seal of approval so people could think that this was all fine and dandy. The only two subject matter experts on this committee refused to sign off on them. Dr. Sandra Sotsky, the English expert, said, no way, we're taking out all the good literacy. We're going to reduce the critical thinking abilities of children with this. These standards are terrible. I'm not approving them. The other expert, Dr. James Milgram from Stanford, said, nope, I'm not approving this. These standards are not clear. They're terrible. And some of them are based on incorrect math. Those are his words, not mine. People can go read his letter. It's fascinating. Now, they're rolling this out across the entire country. Now, that's either massive lunacy or massive criminality. You take your pick.
All right. Not a happy middle ground there between criminality and lunacy. Listen, friends, here's what's scary. Alex is not saying that the Illuminati are behind this or that this is a UFO invasion. He's saying, hey, this stuff is known. Read about John Dewey. Read about the Humanist Manifesto. read about the eugenic philosophy of some of the founders of our modern education system. Look back at the original goals of American education. Compare it to today. Look, the sexual anarchy of our culture is reinforced within the schools and sex education programs. Is this just coincidence or part of a larger wrong approach to education? And many educators who are frustrated, this may be a life-changing book to read. Crimes of the Educators, and we barely scratched the surface, over 300 pages, but every page engagingly written, how utopians are using government schools to destroy America's children, Samuel Blumenfeld and Alex Newman. Alex, you've gotten me thinking beyond where I'm normally thinking and brought a challenge to our listening audience. Thank you for writing the book and joining us on the broadcast.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate the opportunity.
All right, friends, again, the name of the book, Crimes of the Educators. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, I do want to get to some comments Annalise Stanley made at the very beginning of the broadcast. I said this week, really meaning the past week, reported on the past week in particular. I want to express my agreement in part with what Andy Stanley said that's getting a lot of attention. But first, just one call on the issue of ADD, ADHD. Phil in Charlotte, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I did want to ask your guest the question, but I guess you can help me possibly. My question was, how did his research prove that the ADHD that's being diagnosed is coming through the schools? And all the things that he said, a lot of it is obviously very plausible. Most evangelical Christians are going to agree with the school system and Common Core and the disaster that it is. I think we can all see that. Anybody that has a little bit of education can see that. But the ADHD, there are many kids that are diagnosed with that prior to going to school.
Right, right. So there are two sides to it, and I anticipated some of these questions, and I just didn't have the time to get into them further. And, of course, the book does get into things further. The category ADD, ADHD is something that has subsequently been made. In other words, it's not like you had this thing, as he said, a broken bone or cancer. This is a particular set of responses or conditions, and now we put it in that category. So the category is a made thing. And his thesis would be that the category itself ties in with the educational method, which then produces certain results and in the brain of children, and then the way that we deal with it is to medicate them. Let's say plainly that there is no condemnation on anyone or criticism of anyone if your kid has been diagnosed with some issues and you found that medication is a way to help in many ways. It may be necessary. God knows each condition. And certainly there are kids who, yes, have symptoms that would be very much in keeping with what we call ADD, ADHD, from very early ages. I know of a case personally like that. We're very, very early. I mean, very, very early, just when the child was an infant. A family member said there's something a little funny there and then was evident. And the kid just had to get extra attention because of it. So I'll have to let folks read through the book to get more information on that. But certainly the larger argument they're making is the structure of our educational system does not cater to the many different personalities of children and ways that they learn. And because of that, then creates certain negative behaviors, which then become manifest in what is called ADD and ADHD. Perhaps that would be the more specific way to bring the argument. And I'm going to look in these chapters.
Yeah, I think that sounds more plausible. Yeah. I think that sounds more plausible because you're leaving out a whole segment within the study that would be prior to entering
exactly
that educational system.
Yeah, and I imagine as carefully as Alex and Dr. Blumenfeld have thought about these issues that they would have answers to these. But I did want to get to your question before the hour was out because certainly others are asking the same question. And for educators and those in the educational system, no condemnation, but it's just a large shout to look at a better way and to raise major questions. And for those in the Christian schools and homeschooling who have flexibility, use that flexibility to educate in the best way. Thank you, sir, for the call. Important question. All right. Andy Stanley had made some recent comments that are now getting quoted on gay websites and elsewhere. For example, mega church pastor rejects his father's bigotry. Jesus would want you to bake a gay wedding cake. And in any case, Andy Stanley had said, look, that the church should be the safest place for a gay teenager. Now, if he meant for a kid struggling with same-sex attraction, he should be able to come there and tell his youth pastor, hey, I'm struggling in these ways. Absolutely. Absolutely. As opposed to think God hates me and is sending me to hell. Absolutely. And listen to what Andy Stanley says. On the one hand, he urged Christians to, quote, take a break from the culture wars for a year and lead by example. Now, here's what I like. He said, if all the Christians for just 1 year would quit looking at porn, would quit smoking weed, would quit having premarital sex, would quit committing adultery, would pay their taxes, and every church just foster one kid, in 1 year our nation would feel different. Now, it's true because there's so much compromise in the church. It's true because there's so much sin in the body. He also said there are so many Christians, so basically if we would just be better Christians, everything we would like to see change for the most part would change. In many ways, that is true. He said, serving people you don't see eye to eye with is the essence of Christianity. Jesus died for a world with which he didn't see eye to eye. If a bakery doesn't want to sell its products to a gay couple, it's their business, literally, but leave Jesus out of it. Now, it's not a matter of selling products to a gay couple. It's participating in a gay, quote, wedding. And for many Christians, there are many things they wouldn't participate in good conscience. So here, first, I commend Andy Stanley for speaking out plainly against sin in the body. To repeat, if all the Christians for just 1 year would quit looking at porn, would quit smoking weed, would quit having premarital sex, would quit committing adultery, would pay their taxes, and every church has fostered one kid, in 1 year our nation would feel different. I wholeheartedly agree. And I've said for many years, the greatest problem in America is not so much the presence of darkness, it's the absence of light. Yes, amen. I agree. Well, it's my own quote. Of course I agree with it. But I agree with what Andy Stanley said. My problem is that the culture war is not going away. In other words, we can't take a year off. The Supreme Court may make a dire ruling regarding redefining marriage. There are plenty of people who, in good conscience, cannot participate in your photographer, and you just can't get two people or two men to pose and smooch for the camera. You can't do that in good conscience. Just like other things you couldn't do in good conscience. If there was a, you know, Playboy spread and they wanted to hire you to take pictures, well, you can't do that in good conscience. You serve those you don't agree with, yeah, but you don't violate your own conscience and deny the faith in the process. The culture wars aren't going away. What do you tell the parents who are upset over what's happening in their children's schools? What do you tell the children? Well, we're taking a year off from this. You can't do that. What do you tell the people with legislative issues? What do you tell the Christians who are fired from their jobs simply because they hold to biblical morality and make that known when they're asked a question? What do you tell educators who are told you can't teach certain things and kids that are put out of college because they hold to certain values? The war rages on. So why not do both? Why not major on living differently and living godly lives and living like followers of Jesus, but not neglect the culture wars? Why make it one or the other? So amen in part, but still missing an important point on the other side. All right, friends, a really exciting special resource offer, a 12-hour college-level class I taught on the Messiah in Jewish tradition. You'll find it absolutely fascinating, and you don't have to know Hebrew. We take you through things. We have a study guide as well. Just $20 for the CD of the entire course, or $15 to download it. Yeah, no, that's not a mental typo. That's exactly right. We want to get it to you. We've never offered it like this before. Call 1-800-278-9978. 1-800-278-9978. Or Go to the website, askdrbrown.org, for more. My bottom line today, there's a whole lot more messed up in this world than we realize. It's up to us, followers of Jesus, to turn things right side up.